Our first reading this morning is from the first letter of John, chapter 3, and you'll find it on page 1227 of the Church Bible. 1 John, chapter 3, and we begin to read at verse 16. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth. This is the word of the Lord. The second reading is from Mark chapter 9. You can find it on page 1013 in the Church Bible. Mark chapter 9, beginning to read at verse 33. Jesus and his disciples came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child whom he placed among them. Taking the child in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good morning, everybody. Gospel, of course, means good news. And the Christian gospel is indeed good news. The message about Jesus and what he has done for us through his coming, his dying on the cross, his rising again, offers people unconditional forgiveness. It offers them an entry into a new community. It offers them strength to live by from day to day. And it offers hope for the life to come. And in the world where we are bombarded by free offers, for my money, this is the best free offer around. So our churches ought to be crammed full, given the nature of that offer. But with some notable exceptions, they are not. So why is it that people outside the doors of the churches don't get it? What is holding them back from accepting this wonderful free offer? What is the biggest single obstacle today to people coming to faith in Jesus Christ? Well, there are a number of possible answers that we could maybe suggest to that question, but I believe that our passage from Mark's Gospel this morning points at least towards one possible answer, and it's an answer that's not particularly comfortable for us as Christians to hear. Because the answer, according to the passage we've just had read from Mark's Gospel, lies in the church itself, and its failure to live out, to embody the gospel that Jesus has entrusted to us. Now, there are three occasions in Mark's gospel where Jesus pulls the curtain back on what lies ahead of him, where he reveals to his disciples what is going to happen and what is going to become the very heart of the Christian message. Three occasions on which Jesus says, I am going to suffer and die for the sins of the world, but I'm going to be raised from death in victory. And on each of those occasions, the disciples refuse to hear what Jesus is saying. And immediately afterwards, they go on to say or do something that shows that they haven't even begun to understand what the message that Jesus has just given them was all about. The first occasion is back in chapter 8 of Mark's Gospel. You might want just to turn back to that if you've got your Bible open. Mark 8, verse 31, we're told he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this. So that's the first occasion. What happens? Immediately Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Peter takes it on himself to tick Jesus off for what he said. That's the first occasion. The second one is immediately before the passage we've just had read for us this morning. In chapter 9, verse 31, Jesus says to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him. After 3 days he will rise. Mark says, but they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. Then immediately Mark tells us about this big argy-bargy that the disciples have on the road to Capernaum. That's the second one. And the third one is in chapter 10, verses 32 onwards. They're on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. Jesus takes the 12 aside. He tells them what's going to happen to them. He says, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They'll condemn him to death. They'll hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. And immediately afterwards, what does Mark tell us? Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him with a request. The request was, we want to be the special ones. We want to sit at your right and your left hand when you come into your glory. They hadn't got it. So there's a pattern here. And what's the connection that Mark wants us to see between the message that Jesus keeps repeating about what is going to happen to him and the words and actions of the disciples, rather stupid words and actions that in each case follow? We're looking at the second one this morning. So what in particular does the second of these three episodes recorded by Mark have to teach us that might be relevant to our presentation of the Christian message today? Well, first of all, I think Mark wants us to notice where the real spiritual blockage lies that is preventing those who claim to follow Jesus from being effective witnesses to his message. So the first heading this morning is the spiritual blockage exposed, and we find that in verses 33 and 34 of our passage. What had that fierce argument on the road to Capernaum been all about? Jesus asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? He knew the answer, I'm sure, but he asked the question. The disciples had been playing verbal games of spiritual one-upmanship. Which of them was the greatest? Maybe the Apostle John had claimed it was him. John had the greatest depth of spiritual insight. He had the best theological mind. Surely he had claims to be the greatest. Or no doubt Peter had weighed in. I've got the gift of the gab. I've got leadership qualities in abundance. Trust me, I'm strong and stable. Well, Peter, he proved himself not to be so strong and stable. Perhaps Andrew had put himself forward, really gifted, the most effective introducer of others to Jesus. Maybe there were others. But whoever was at the forefront of these arguments, the sad reality is that they still carry on in the church of today. Games of spiritual one-upmanship. Some of our denominations perhaps even invite the problem by our fondness for formal titles and modes of address. If I may be allowed to amend the words of that classic TV comedy sketch, we can imagine the Anglican clergyman saying, well, I look down on him because he's only a reverend, whereas I am a very reverend. I look up to him because he's a most reverend. Forgive my cheek, that's my Baptist biases coming out here. But we don't make it easier for ourselves by our fondness for titles. But before we're too hard on our own Anglican tradition, we should note that there are many other forms that this one-upmanship can take. I look down on her because she doesn't understand sound Christian doctrine, whereas I am reformed. Or perhaps I look down on him because he hasn't been baptized in the Spirit, whereas I am exercising the full gifts of the Spirit. Or it may simply be, I look down on her because she hasn't simply got the experience that I have in this church. I've been doing that job for 25 years and I know how it should be done. It's all around us. The disease of spiritual one-upmanship or one-up-womanship is universal throughout all sections of the Christian church. It's about time we recognized it for what it is and called a spade a spade. As Christians, we need to hear what Jesus has to say about it, because it is a significant blockage to our being usable by God. The spiritual blockage exposed. But secondly, what did Jesus have to say then to these argumentative disciples jockeying for position? And furthermore, how exactly did he say what he had to say? How did Jesus demonstrate that there was a very different way of approaching human community, and that he had the authority to point towards that very different way? So the second heading is Jesus' spiritual authority asserted. Jesus' spiritual authority asserted in verse 35. Mark tells us, sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said. Now, I'm sure we're all used to the instruction, often given in a thick German accent, mimicking a host of Second World War films. Listen very carefully, because I'm going to say this only once. How would we react if somebody said, listen very carefully, because I'm going to sit down only once. Listen very carefully, because I'm going to sit down and speak. Sitting down was a signal of a Jewish rabbi's unique teaching authority. It was a signal. When I go in to lecture to undergraduates in the University of Edinburgh, I walk into the lecture room, I go to the podium, I stand in front of a class, and bit by bit they dribble in. I expect my students to come in and sit down. And any student who comes in but remains standing at the back of a class is being a bit rude and would receive a gentle but firm invitation from me, "Will you sit down, please? We're about to start. The lecture's about to begin." In Western culture, we talk about sitting under the authority of our teachers. But in Israel, it was precisely the other way around. It was the pupils who stood throughout the lesson in respect and attention, eager to catch every word that fell from the lips of their seated master and teacher. So at the end of this walk in which this heated argument had gone on, Jesus summons the 12 disciples to come in and to stand before him, and he sits down. No doubt it was then that the realization sunk in that he had something pretty serious to say to them, and that it was an authoritative response to what they'd been arguing about on the road. What Jesus said was very brief. It was a short and simple paradox intended to make clear that spiritual one-upmanship ought to have no place in the community of his followers. What does Jesus say? He says, if you want to discover what it really means in my kingdom to have status, to have greatness, you've got to be prepared to be bottom dog. You've got to be the one who willingly meets the needs and obeys the commands of everyone else in the pack. This isn't a question of a cynical strategic move of adopting the manner of an ever-so-humble servant as a cunning plan in order to end up as top dog. It's much more profound than that. It's about letting the deep meaning of the gospel of Jesus to soak into our minds, to begin to affect our attitudes at the deepest possible level, until we realize that serving Christ and seeking power over others simply do not belong together. There's a fundamental mismatch between serving Christ and seeking to dominate other people. That's the simple but deeply unsettling message that came from the mouth of this seated teacher. Jesus sat down to signal that he was going to teach with authority. That was what he said, something very simple but very unsettling. What he said was also powerfully illustrated by what he then did. Jesus used a visual aid. So thirdly, the key spiritual truth illustrated, verses 36 and 37. The key spiritual truth illustrated. We live in an age of educational technology. PowerPoint, slides, smart boards, and whatever. And sometimes we tend to imagine that our generation is the first one to have realized the importance of visual aids in teaching. Well, no. Visual aids of one kind or another are as old as the relationship between teacher and pupil. What does Jesus do? He reinforces what he has just said by using a living visual aid. He picks out a young child from whatever gathering they were in. He takes that child into the very center of the gathered assembly, and he gives him or her a big hug. Then he says, "Whoever welcomes a child such as this in my name is in effect welcoming me and the Father who sent me." Now, there are two things we need to notice here. The first is to observe in the first century, children were not to be the center of attention. They were expected to obey, to serve, to learn. Jesus is overturning those values by taking the littlest, the least important person, and placing them right at the very center. That was saying something to those disciples after their power games. The second point we should note is that in the Aramaic language that Jesus and the disciples spoke, the word for child, talia, can equally mean servant. So what's Jesus doing? I don't think he's simply telling the disciples, this is how you should treat children, although I think that's part of it. But rather, he's saying, what should mark you out from the rest of humanity is that you should be willing to take the most despised elements of society, children, servants, and you should be willing to become servants of them. Look at the child, look at the servant, and that's the model you should follow. So how does all this relate to what Jesus has just been teaching the disciples about the fact that he's going to be betrayed into the hands of men, that he's going to meet his death at their hands, that he's going to die the despised death of a criminal on a cross? Well, surely Jesus is saying, look, I'm going to allow myself to be betrayed, to be humiliated, to be strung up on a cross as a common criminal, because that is the pathway of obedience to my Father's will and of love for you that I have to take. Because that is the only way that my kingdom, my Father's kingdom, is going to be established. That is the way to the kingdom. And if you want to be part of that kingdom, then you too have to tread that path of being a servant or a child. You too have to become a nobody for the sake of the kingdom, for the sake of the Father. And if you live like that, you will actually be living out, embodying the good news I've come to bring to the world. That's, I think, what Jesus was doing when he took that child and put them right at the center. Warning, I'm going to use a big word, a theologian's word now. One of the great missionary thinkers of the late 20th century was Leslie Newbegin, a bishop in the Church of South India. And he was very fond of saying that the church is called to be, here's the big word, the hermeneutic of the gospel. The church is called to be the hermeneutic of the gospel. Well, what does that mean? Hermeneutics is the science of interpreting a message, interpreting a text, working out what it really means. So Newbegin was saying, when people out there look at the church, they ought to be able to read off the gospel by looking at our life together. They should be able to understand what the gospel is all about by looking at how Christians treat one another and treat others, treat all humanity. So what they see should not be Christians arguing with each other about who is top dog, Rather, what they see should be the power of sacrificial service. And hence to see the wonder of the love of Christ who gave himself up as a ransom for many. There's a remarkable story from the Second World War, from the experience of British prisoners of war, from the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, who were being forced by the Japanese to construct the notorious bridge over the River Kwai in Thailand. At the end of one particular day's work, the working party had to count up all the tools that they were using to make sure that none had gone missing to be sold off for profit. And as the work party was about to be dismissed, one of the Japanese guards shouted in fury that a shovel was missing. He insisted that one of the work party had hidden it in order to sell it to the Thais to make money. The Japanese guard became irate, demanding that the culprit own up. All die, he screamed. He cocked his rifle to shoot the entire work party. Then one of those Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders calmly stepped forward and said, "I did it." The guard unleashed the full brunt of his hatred against that man and beat him to death in front of his friends. But when the party got back to the camp, the tools were counted again. It was discovered that there had been a mistake. There was no shovel missing after all. That innocent man had made himself a servant. He'd willingly died for the sake of his mates. We don't know specifically whether he was a Christian, but I think it's very likely. And certainly Ernest Gordon, who recorded the episode in his book, Miracle on the River Kwai, certainly was. Now we should be very careful not to draw any sort of analogy between that crazed Japanese guard and our loving Heavenly Father, because it was our Father of his own gracious will and initiative who freely delivered up his own Son to die for us. That moving story is not to be read as an exact picture of what the atonement is all about. But nonetheless, it does say something to us. And what Jesus meant, and what Leslie Newbegin meant by the church being the hermeneutic of the gospel, is that we are called to live like that. We are called to live as a community of Christians so that something of the wonder of what Jesus has done for us is reflected in how we live and how we treat one another. That's exactly what the Apostle John said in our first reading this morning, from 1 John chapter 3. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or with tongue, but with actions and in truth. That's tough. One of the first theologians of the early church, a man called Tertullian, wrote that the most powerful witness of the Christians of his day to the North African society in which they lived was the quality of their life together as a community. He summed up that pagan reaction by the phrase, "Look how they love one another. Look how they love one another." That's the challenge that God has for us this morning and every day in our life as a church. Is the world actually able to look at the Christian church and see that transparent, that powerful quality of Christian community together and not spiritual one-upmanship? May God, through his Spirit, whom he has given to us to live amongst us and in us, may he enable us to reflect what Jesus has done for us in our life together as Christians, so that people will indeed be able to read the gospel writ large in our lives. Amen.